Negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
In each of the 27 EU nations, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will start being used in less than a week's time, on the 27th of December. The European Medicines Agency has given its approval and has played down concerns that the new highly contagious COVID-19 variant spreading in England will not respond to the vaccine.
These are issues that need to be fully scientifically assessed. At the moment, we can say that there is no evidence to suggest that the vaccine will not work against the new variant of the coronavirus.
The UK is now isolated as countries around the world impose travel restrictions due to the new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. There has been travel chaos for millions. People have been trying to get out of the UK before travel bans are enforced. There is major disruption at the main trading corridors between the UK and EU. Global markets have been in disarray due to the deepening health crisis in Europe. Rather than waiting for other countries to make the first move, epidemiologists are saying the British government should have done the responsible thing and blocked all non-essential travel from the UK. We have been getting reactions from members of the public in Brussels.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
It's a new thing, we don't know what it is, but we need to act, I think, faster, and maybe in the beginning a little bit harder.
If government imposed like that strict lockdown like they did in South Korea or like North Korea and China, I think there will be riots here.
The European Medicines Agency says it is currently in contact with 46 vaccine developers, and it expects to approve the Moderna jab on the 6th of January. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Can you download an HD movie in 1 second? Thanks to 5G internet? Yes. While around 50 countries have already launched the fifth generation broadband service, Iran is also jumping on the wagon to roll out the high-speed internet network. Iran's Science and Technology Vice Presidency says 5G coverage will for now be available in the country's Kish Island and will soon reach other regions.
We can now say that Iran is one of the first countries that stepped into this modern technology. We have built the needed infrastructure in Kish Island and at the same time are working on major locations such as Tehran to roll out the technology.
Iran successfully tested 5G in July, when users reported a 1.5 gigabit per second of download speed on their mobile phones. However, Iran's ST Vice Presidency says 5G for now will not be offered for household applications and will initially be limited to industrial uses, such as smart transportation.
With 5G's low latency, reliability and powerful connections, we can create an integrated transport network that connects all cars together and also connects personal cars to police for instant guidance and warnings.
Not also in our country, but also most of the countries, 5G infrastructures aren't implemented yet. So we need past time for implementing these infrastructures. And after that, we can use the use cases of 5G.
The deployment of 5G technology is expected to boost Iran's infrastructure for accommodating sensitive online services through domestic servers. Experts say this will significantly increase the cloud computing capacity in the country.
Some 70 million Iranian SIM card owners currently use the third and fourth generation of mobile internet. They still have to wait to see the 5G icon appearing on the top corner of their smartphones. But Iran's ICT officials promised to make 5G internet available for widespread personal use by the end of 2022. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas. But that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test.
Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homolezki, Vienna.
The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the dire economic conditions in the blockaded Gaza Strip, leaving a huge impact on the livelihoods of people in the tiny coastal enclave. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has already caused a sharp decline in the standards of living, as well as alarming levels of unemployment and poverty in the seaside sliver even before the pandemic. Meanwhile, tight lockdown measures to contain COVID-19 have had grave economic implications on all sectors in the Gaza Strip. Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has brought the blockaded enclave's economy to a virtual standstill, driving more Palestinians into poverty.
Economy is a vital lifeline, and the Israeli blockade has crippled this lifeline. The coronavirus restrictions have only worsened the situation. Currently, around 85% of the population live below the poverty line, with an average income of only $2 a day.
Lockdowns are directly affecting thousands of daily wage laborers and their dependents, and resulting in suspension of operations in the vast majority of businesses in the Gaza Strip. The coronavirus pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected economies all over the world. In Gaza, we're suffering the most amid this pandemic because of the ongoing blockade and the lack of resources.
The economy is in a very bad shape, especially during lockdowns, and shops and restaurants are closed. Many businesses had to lay off workers because they can't pay their wages.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 33,000 coronavirus infections since late August. In an attempt to curb the rapid spread of the deadly virus, local authorities currently impose lockdowns from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
We have imposed lockdowns as part of our preventive measures to slow the spread of the deadly virus. The Ministry of Interior is sparing no effort to minimize the number of coronavirus cases. The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is very high, and we are trying different approaches to contain the virus.
Experts say the pandemic will exacerbate the underlying humanitarian crisis that has gripped Gaza for years.
The COVID-19 pandemic is adding extra strains on Gaza's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished enclave are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
We speak about combating oppression on the basis of rationality. Therefore, our pursuit of justice and our social activities should be based on rationality and correct calculations as well. We should not busy ourselves with peripheral matters, and we should not confuse main and trivial matters. Of course, I mentioned that one element of our national power is our defensive power, but another element consists of economic matters and economic stability and strength. The last element is cultural matters. When the issue of cultural invasion arose, we found the enemy perplexed as he entered the arena with the idea of confronting the slogan of fighting against cultural invasion. This means that the enemy feared that you might awaken and might understand that there is a cultural invasion. The same is true of economic matters.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Of course, economic problems result from pressure. In the present time, we have certain economic and livelihood problems, all of which are resolvable. I do not believe that officials in charge of economic matters are not working hard. This is not the case, as many efforts are being made, some of which are good. Of course, there are shortcomings in the area of management capability. We acknowledge that in certain economic areas, management efficiency is poor. We have passed good bills, but they should be pursued. I said this here so that as well as our defensive power, which is one of our most important issues, economic matters receive due attention, and so that we adopt a comprehensive outlook towards all these matters. Management in all areas should be strong, active, and untiring. Whenever we had managers with these qualities, tirelessness, activeness, and enthusiasm, we witness the progress of affairs, and whenever such active and constant presence is lacking, we certainly face problems.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, relations between China and the United States continue to deteriorate. From a trade war with Washington taxing and even sanctioning some Chinese entities, to the U.S.'s promoting Taiwan as a separate nation, to Washington's Navy presence in the Taiwan Strait, have all been techniques used to pressure Beijing. Now, the waters are very murky between the two right now, and we will take a look at what the future may hold for China-U.S. ties in this debate.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. It said the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the Strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan, but some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope, is trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions, or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman, out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angelo Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Thank you both for being with us. So let's start this off with Lawrence. Now, Washington says Taiwan is a separate nation. China says it is part of the People's Republic of China. According to international law, it is one country with two governments. What does it all mean in your perspective?
This idea of China being one country with two governments has been accepted for many, many years. And to disrupt this political understanding is quite dangerous. The problem is that President Trump, even though he started out trying to establish friendly, cordial, amiable relations with President Xi Jinping, has deteriorated and now has adopted the geopolitical doctrine, which says that there's a zero-sum game in the world as a chessboard, and there are either winners or losers. And the United States has now determined under President Trump that it has to have hegemony and has to put down and keep under China, which is emerging as a great superpower and a very powerful economy. And this doctrine is unfortunate, and it's a problem for both the United States and China and for the world, because it can get quite dangerous, as we're seeing in your description earlier.
Well, Angelo, why does the United States want to stir up this hornet nest am with China when both, as our previous guests said, I mean, as a matter of fact, with souring relations, it would appear that both actually would suffer. So why stir up this hornet nest?
I think the USA, they know too well that Taiwan, pushing for Taiwan independence is the line not to cross, and this could be a case for war. So basically, they're using Taiwan as a call against China. So lately, the US has invested deeply a lot into the DPP, which is the ruling party in Taiwan. And this party is advocating for independence. So China's sovereignty over Taiwan is the line not to cross. And the U.S. is trying to use this as a pawn in either to probably to go into a negotiation of the coming new reset of the new world order, which would be which a lot of things would be renegotiated, including trading and currency and debt. So I think in the best case it's a pawn for negotiation. In the worst case, it's using Taiwan for putting war in the region.
Okay, well, Lawrence, what do you think? Is the rift between the U.S. and China mostly because Washington cannot tolerate any other country except itself being on top, and China has already taken over the slot for having the largest economy, and it's threatening to surpass Washington in other fields?
Yes, well, this is a problem because actually the U.S. interest, as an American, I know what the U.S. interests are, and the U.S. interests are not to be antagonistic to China. There are great things that the two superpowers and the two great economies, two largest economies, can accomplish in the future. So this is not in the American interest. What you have is you have an ideology best represented by people like Secretary of State Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and many, many others. They believe that China is a threat. It's not a threat. It can be a collaborator. It can be an ally in development in many areas, which I could outline. So this is a doctrine alien to actually what the United States stands for. We could be working with China on space and technology. We could be working with China on developing the rest of the world, including Africa. There are many areas of common interest. There is no basis for this conflict and this tension, which President Trump did not espouse when he first came into office. But unfortunately, he's given into it, and it also fits in with the prejudices of his base of supporters who are anti-China. Anti-China, China, China is not in the American interest. It's a danger to the United States. And if there ever was even the idea of decoupling the United States from China, it would be a disaster. And as our friend has reported, it is a causability for war if the United States keeps supporting Taiwan.
What about that, Angela? Do you agree with our previous guests? And if so, if it's not in the interests of the United States, whose interest is it in? Why are we seeing then this policy being implemented?
I think it's important to see who's really ruling the U.S. We have Biden and Trump being the face, but behind there are people who have the informal power, which are the military complex and the bankers. So I think it's very important to know that those are only puppets in the front, just, you know, and behind they're putting pressure because a lot of money. A lot of people are benefiting from war and from tensions, especially the military complex. So, and then I think there's a cultural problem in the U.S. because there's this culture of exceptionalism, to be the best and to want to export Western culture values, and there's a deep misunderstanding of China. I personally have lived 25 years in China, and I only now start to really understand what is behind the culture and what Chinese want. And while in the U.S. there's not the slightest understanding of what China, the aspiration of China. China is not looking for hegemony, has a history of not interfering in other countries' affairs, and what it wants is prosperity for its people. That's all it wants. So there's a deep misunderstanding, and so the hawks are just using the misunderstanding and the media just to further demonize China.
Yeah, what about that, Lawrence? Angela said some interesting things there, trying to demonize China, and there's a misunderstanding culturally, and that the United States or Americans always feel that they should be number one. But on the other hand, if we look at the advances of China, especially if we look at technologically, the U.S. is actually behind China technologically, and yet there's always this image, Americans themselves, that they should be number one, they have to be the best, and it appears almost that Washington will do anything in its power to stop competition, unfortunately not in a fair way. Your take?
Unfortunately, over the last 50 years, I'm a senior citizen now, I've watched the whole process unfold. The United States culture has declined, has shrunk, and Americans don't think on the highest level these days. And Angela is correct. People don't know anything about China. If you look at Confucian philosophy, there is a coherence between Confucian philosophy and Judeo-Western culture in the idea of the common interest of mankind. China has performed a modern-day economic miracle in lifting 750 to 800 million people out of poverty. This could be a benefit to the world. China has just brought back Chang 5 with rocks from the moon, which we can now examine, which will benefit humanity. They also have put a rover on the far side of the moon. There's many things that China is doing in science and economics in terms of the Belt and Road and the infrastructure they're bringing to various nations of the world, including Africa. This is something that the United States has a shared interest in. It benefits all of mankind. And Angela is right. You have a military-industrial complex. You have a group of bankers, financial elite in Wall Street, in London, in Paris, who want to maintain their political power. It's financial political power, and they see China and Russia, to some extent, attempting to usurp that power. That's geopolitics. There is no zero-sum game. Great nations can work together to accomplish great things for mankind, and as an American, I would plead with my fellow Americans to start thinking more strategically, more clearly, and don't buy into the propaganda that's coming out of Pompeo and the State Department.
Well, Angelo, do you see a different foreign policy approach with China under a Biden presidency as opposed to the current U.S. administration? Or do you think we're going to continually see this clash and perhaps even greater clashing? Your assessment?
I would say in the short term, it might get better. But in the long term, it might be more inclined to go to war. I think on the phone, we saw Trump as being very arrogant, using not very appropriate words, but it's only the wording, it's only a facade. I don't think, I think we need to look at facts. No matter if we like or not Trump, in the last 4 years, he hasn't gone to war. While I would doubt that Biden wouldn't have his own war with China. So I think I'm very negative about Biden. Mm-hmm. I don't think he will get better.
So you're saying that under a Biden administration, you feel that it's going to be more hawkish than the previous administration?
Absolutely. If you look at the cabinet and the people surrounding Biden, they come from the Obama era and also from the Bush era. And those ones, they were all criminals. All criminals. Well, if you look at what they did in Libya, in Yemen, and around the world, they're just criminals. So basically, they need wars. Those Biden needs probably his war. Every president needs his war. And I think the possibilities of war are between. It could be Iran, it could be Venezuela, or it could be China. I think it's very hard to predict, but now we can see some advanced indicators that there's a continuation of a pivot to Asia, and this is not like a coincidence that we see warships in the South China Sea.
Well, Lawrence, how likely then, you've just heard, and what our other guests have said, your perspective, how likely is it that these tensions could increase and actually lead to a military confrontation under a Biden term?
I would say there is increasing possibilities that could occur. If you look at the people that President-elect Biden has picked for his cabinet, they do come from the Obama crowd, which launched the Asian pivot in early 2011 against China. They come from some of them come from the Clinton administration, and you have a loud, ignorant chorus of voices coming out of the Democratic Party leadership and the Republican Party, all in an anti-China propagandist mode. And if you look at the people that Biden has, these are people around him who have carried out regime change, who have carried out sanctions, who have carried out and escalated wars. And even though people don't like President Trump's style, and I don't like it, he has not escalated any war. And I think under the Biden administration, we should definitely be concerned that the group of people he's now putting in his government, and he himself and other leading Democrats, could well lead us into a war. It's a very dangerous situation. Unfortunately, Trump has fallen into a very bad policy advisors listening to them on China. So he's leaving the administration on a very sour note with China. And I think Biden will come in and may well escalate the antagonism between the two nations. And all it takes is a small incident somewhere in the South China Sea, and you could see the beginning of a military conflict. I'm very concerned about the Biden administration and its hawkish attitudes towards China, which is already broadcast in various comments it's made. This is a serious, serious problem for us in the United States.
Angela, what about the use of sanctions? We've seen the U.S. now using sanctions to stop Chinese competition for American companies inside of the States, and they've even tried to put pressure on other countries to do the same. Do you see a continuation of this under a Biden administration, trying to block Chinese companies inside of the United States, and also making sure that Washington dictates to other countries to make sure that they also will sanction Chinese companies? How likely is that?
Absolutely. I think the direction the U.S. wants to take is towards decoupling. And I think we've seen Pompeo touring all around the world to pushing for countries to take sides, and this is a very big problem, especially in the Asian area. A lot of countries do not want to take sides. They want peace, but with the U.S., I think they will have a hard time just to have the countries to side with them. I think one of the very few countries in the region that is siding is Australia. But I don't see Japan and other countries siding for the U.S. So it's just a move to further isolate China, and I think this will not work.
And Lawrence, we're almost out of time, but your take, I mean, if you were given the opportunity to actually advise the new American administration that's going to take over in a couple of weeks, what would you say? What would be the way that the United States should be handling foreign relations with China?
I think the United States should recognize we have a common interest with China. As the two economic powerhouses in the world, there are many positive things we can do together. For example, space. Exploring space is one of the most important developments for mankind, to learn the laws of the universe, to discover them for all the benefit of mankind. We should also use China's Belt and Road in their elimination of poverty. I'm an African specialist, and we have 600 million people without electricity in Africa, 400 million people living in poverty. if the United States and China combined their forces and their outlook together and their powers, we could eliminate poverty in Africa and other parts of Southeast Asia. These are the kinds of wonderful things that could be done together. We could develop nuclear power, fusion energy, which has been on the drawing board for a half a century. All these things are possible when powers like the United States and China would collaborate for the better, beneficial development of mankind.
Okay.
And this is what I represent, and this is what the United States should be.
Angela, your take. Do you think that China would actually be willing? You've just heard our other guests discuss the way forward. If he had an opportunity to tell the United States, do you think that China, Beijing, would be willing to cooperate and work with the Americans?
Absolutely. Beijing is looking every opportunity to reconcile with the U.S. He wants to share a future with the U.S. It's not either China or the U.S. They want to work for a multipolar world. And I think this is a China becoming the largest superpower or just getting to the level of the U.S. I think it's a huge opportunity for the world. It's an opportunity just to go from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. It's an opportunity to get out of the American hegemony and the neocolonialism, because we are still half of the world is colonized. If you look at the impact, the pressure the U.S. is putting in South America and in Africa, I think with China would be very different. China could give back dignity to the greater South and could help him decolonize the world, but this is obviously what the U.S. doesn't want.
Okay.
I am for peace. I like very much what our colleague just said before. I am for peace. I think we have huge opportunities, but there are some evil forces that do not think the same as we do. And those evil forces are people, the bankers, and whoever is ruling now the U.S. And it's
okay.
A sad reality.
Unfortunately, I am out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Journalist and political commentator Lawrence Freeman out of Baltimore, and political analyst Angela Giuliano out of Montreux, Switzerland. Appreciate both of you being with us, and as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you next time.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The world's major oil forecasters, the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, slowly began to factor the coronavirus into their outlooks, initially seeing its impact limited to China. but by April it was apparent that the disease was spreading rapidly elsewhere. Forecasts for 2020 oil demand were slashed, and they haven't recovered much in subsequent months, as the statistic chart shows. Oil consumption this year is now expected by all three to be about 10 million barrels a day below the volumes they were forecasting at the end of last year, enough to fuel all of Africa and Latin America. Producers were slow to respond. Seemingly differences between OPEC and its allies sparked a production free-for-all after Russia refused in March to agree to deeper output cuts to help prop up oil supplies. They regrouped the following month and eventually agreed to a record 9.7 million barrels a day reduction from the start of May. We now present you an article written by Julian Lee. The piece is titled Oil's Vaccine Trade Faces Hurdles Ahead. The article has appeared on the front page of the Bloomberg.com website. Please stay with us for more of Julian Lee's article. It's easy to get caught up in oil's recovery. After an exceptionally fraught year, hopes are high that putting 2020 soundly behind us can only mean better days. But there's still a long way to go to get back to anything like normal. That hard reality didn't stop crude prices from rising by $14 a barrel, or 37% since the beginning of November. That's when trial data showed vaccines were proving effective against SARS-CoV-2, followed by the rapid rollout of the first doses in the United Kingdom and the United States. There's a sense of optimism that hasn't been felt since the world woke up early in the year to a new disease that infected many more people around the world. The relief being felt in the oil market is understandable. As the virus spread, it had a devastating impact on lives and livelihoods. The only tool most governments had to slow contagion was to shut down their economies, causing an unprecedented slump in oil demand. The world's major oil forecasters, the International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, slowly began to factor the virus into their outlooks, initially seeing its impact limited to China. But by April, it was apparent that the disease was spreading rapidly elsewhere. Forecasts for 2020 oil demand were slashed, and they haven't recovered much in subsequent months, as statistics charts shows. Oil consumption this year is now expected by all three to be about 10 million barrels a day below the volumes they were forecasting at the end of last year, enough to fuel all of Africa and Latin America. Producers were slow to respond. Seemingly differences between OPEC and its allies sparked a production free-for-all after Russia refused in March to agree to deeper output cuts to help prop up oil prices. They regrouped the following month and eventually agreed to a record 9.7 million barrels a day reduction from the start of May. Further supply cuts came from producers outside of OPEC Plus group, as budgets were slashed and some operations didn't make economic sense anymore. US crude production, which had already peaked in November of last year, fell by 2.7 million barrels a day, or 21%, between March and May of this year. Around one-third of that has been restored in subsequent months. This sluggish response sent oil stockpiles soaring, storage tanks filled, ships were pressed into service to hold excess volumes and spare capacity at Cushing, Oklahoma, the delivery point for the West Texas Intermediary crude contract, dwindling briefly sending prices tumbling into negative territory for the first time ever. By the end of October, oil stockpiles in the developed nations of the OECD were still above the peak reached during the 2016 surge that preceded the formation of OPEC Plus, even though they had been falling for the previous 3 months. Production discipline among the OPEC Plus producers, who've been kept in line by main producing countries, has created the supply deficit needed to draw down stockpiles. Although the cartel's de facto leaders haven't called out the group's second largest overproducers in volume terms, they have been prepared to ruffle feathers closer to home, singling out some countries like the United Arab Emirates for failing to abide by their production targets. As a result, the group's overall compliance with its output targets has been better than anyone expected. But there's still a long way to go. The latest forecasts from the three agencies show global oil demand lagging the corresponding 2019 levels throughout next year, and that's even with all the positive vaccine news. And the outlook's getting worse, not better. OPEC's own analysts have cut their forecasts for 2021 oil demand with each new report since July, when they first began publishing quarterly numbers for next year. The demand recovery is patchy, both geographically and sectorally, and it's likely to stay that way. It's also going to be very susceptible to the ups and downs of the battle to defeat the coronavirus pandemic. Tighter restrictions are once again in place in much of Europe and in some significant markets in Asia. New cases are rising in South Korea, although the country is not yet at the point of lightening social distancing rules, while a fresh wave of infections is causing challenges for Japan's fragile recovery. Different recovery speeds for different products are creating their own challenges for the refining sector, while diesel demand is picking up as online shopping boosts the need for delivery trucks. Jet fuel consumption is still being hammered, with commercial flights stuck at about 60% of comparable levels last year. Those disparities are unlikely to change anytime soon, with many people likely to remain wary of flying for months to come. The approval of effective vaccines marked the beginning of a post-pandemic world. But we'd be foolish to think that just because we can see a finish line, it means we've actually reached it. There's still a long way to go, and the next few months will be tricky, both for the people's health and well-being, and for economies around the world, and also for the oil sector.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.